Yeah, thank you. Hello, everyone. This is my name is Christopher Coker. I'm director of LSE Ideas, which is the main foreign policy think tank of the London School of Economics. I'd also like to welcome you on behalf of our partners, the RATSU Forum, and this particular program that we run together called 2020 Visions. And we're here today as part of our Central and Southeast Europe program at Ideas to discuss the likely impact of a Biden presidency on the security foreign policy situation in Central and Eastern Europe. There's a great deal to discuss, so I shall confine my opening remarks to just very few observations. First, to say that there will, I think, be a certain nostalgia for the Trump administration in certain quarters in Central and Eastern Europe, because certain people rather liked their brand of nationalism, even if they had misgivings, perhaps, about his personal relationship with Vladimir Putin. There'll certainly be concern in Budapest and Warsaw for Biden's unqualified support of the European Union and its normative foreign policy, human rights, democracy, the rule of law. And I think there'll be some misgivings in some East European capitals about the coming pushback against China, now identified by the European Union as a systemic threat to the European project. And it looks likely, I think, that Biden will push for what The Economist in the most recent issue calls a new grand bargain on tech against China, a kind of new partnership between the EU and the United States. So there's a lot to talk about, many other aspects and features of the relationship. The relationship's going to be, I think, more interesting than it has been in the last 4 years under Trump, and certainly more eventful. So without further ado, can I just introduce our speakers? We have three excellent experts today. This is the order in which they will speak. Ivan Vojvoda, who is permanent fellow and director of the Europe Futures Project at the Human Sciences University of Vienna. He will speak first. Karina Rabidja, who is director for Democratic Resilience at the Center for European Policy Analysis. And finally, Wojciech Miśnik, who's Assistant Professor of International Relations and Security Studies at the Jagiellonian University in Krakow. I'd also like to introduce Megan Palmer, who is the Program Director for the Central and Southeast Europe Program at Ideas, who put this panel together, which I'd like to thank her. And for certain technical reasons, she will be also handling the question and answer session after our three panelists have opened with their initial remarks. I've asked them to speak for no more than 10 minutes each so that we can at least have half an hour of Q&A. So Ivan, if I could start with you, please. You need to unmute.
Yeah, however many times one does this, one forgets that one needs to unmute. Well, thank you very much, Christopher, and to LSE Ideas and Megan for this opportunity to be with you and talk about these important issues. First of all, I'd like to say that I expect there will be more continuity than one would think on the issue of Southeastern Europe or the Balkans, which I will be specifically talking about in terms of the implications of and the impact of this presidential election, or rather the policy that one can expect from President-elect Biden and his foreign policy team. I say that because obviously the Western Balkans and Southeastern Europe are not a key focus of American foreign policy. They are what Biden has called, since the time he was chairing the Foreign Affairs Committee of the U.S. Senate, unfinished business in the Balkans, by which he meant, and Americans mean, that a Europe whole, free, and at peace, as was declared by Bush older, is still not accomplished until the Western Balkans are fully part of the Euro-Atlantic family, and that means members of the European Union and of NATO. Now, that progress has been moving much more slowly, at a snail's pace, one could say, and yet it has advanced in terms of NATO. The latest members, as you know, were Montenegro in 2017 and North Macedonia in 2020. And in terms of EU integration, Croatia joined in 2013. What will definitely be different with respect to the Trump administration is that there will be a return to a far greater level of cooperation with the European Union. The European Union has launched a new phase, not only with what was called the Berlin process that Chancellor Merkel launched in 2015 to give more substance to the EU enlargement, but also to the fact that there's a special representative, Miroslav Lajcak, the former Slovak deputy prime minister and foreign minister, who is now fully engaged on resolving the Serbia-Kosovo issue, but maybe a few words more later on that. And as the Trump administration has been flying solo with the former ambassador Grenell to Germany, who tried to make himself more prominent, U.S. Administration State Department officials were always present at the European Union meetings with Miroslav Lajcak in the last course. So, and thirdly, maybe most importantly, Joseph Biden and his foreign policy team, and I'm thinking especially of Tony Blinken, are probably the U.S. foreign policy people who have the greatest and deepest knowledge of Southeastern Europe. I had the honor to testify before Joe Biden in 2004 in July at the Foreign Affairs Committee. The title, unsurprisingly, of the hearing was Unfinished Business in the Balkans. So that's 16 years ago. And Tony Blinken, as his national security advisor when he was vice president, is someone who is intimately aware of the Balkans. They've both visited many times over these past 20 years. Joe Biden was involved very much when the Bosnian War was ongoing, and they both know the actors of the region. And for example, Joseph Biden has met, for example, the president of Serbia at least four times while he was vice president and visited Belgrade. I think that's very important because they know the ins and outs. They know the way in which the political leaders in the region operate. And because they are fully cognizant and supportive of the key role that the European Union has, that they will be supporting it as they had also under the Obama administration. So the U.S. in this case takes, for lack of a better metaphor, the backseat role in a car or the side seat to the driver who helps navigate and pushes the Euro-Atlantic integration agenda forward. That is extremely important because the U.S. has much more leverage, for example, in countries such as Albania or Kosovo, and the EU cannot advance on the EU integration path without the support of the United States. In terms of security and defense, there's more than meets the eye. All of these countries are either members of Partnership for Peace and are at various stages of individual partnership action plans, the IPAP plans, or are full members of NATO. There's also a regional NATO cooperation called the Adriatic Five, in which they participate. And each of these countries has a special relationship with one of the United States National Guards. For example, for Serbia, it's the Ohio National Guard that has been the key partner. And NATO has much more activity than any other third actor in the region. There's a lot of talk about Serbia's closeness to Russia. You look at the number of military exercises, it's 10 to 1 in favor of NATO. And that is often disregarded or overlooked as one looks at the region. The one thing that the Trump administration did recently was a sort of a summit meeting in the Oval Office at the White House between the president of Serbia and the prime minister of Kosovo, Abdullah Hoti. Much to say about that meeting, but I'll simply say what I think will remain from that meeting, and that is the decision already implemented that the United States will open its first European Office of its International Development Financial Corporation, which will cover the whole of the Balkan regions, including Greece, Bulgaria, and Romania, to support investments. I would simply say that this is the result of the fact that the US and the EU have been less active in the region over the past more than 5 years, which has opened the space for what we euphemistically call the third actors, Russia, China, the Emiratis, and Turkey. And suddenly there was a wake-up call coming from Washington, and the fact that they decided to bring in this arm of the United States investment activity, I think, is extremely important. And I think that the Biden administration will simply carry that baton forward, again, working closely with the European Union itself. One cannot, of course, disregard the activities of a Russia or a China, and we can maybe say a few more words on that later on. But definitely this new page that has been turned will be reinforced with the incoming administration. Let me just add that the current team at the State Department with Assistant Secretary of State Philip Reker, again, someone extremely knowledgeable of the region. He was ambassador to Macedonia about 10, 15 years ago. And the principal deputy assistant secretary, Matthew Palmer, again, someone who's extremely knowledgeable and has been part of the negotiations. Final word, as I said, on probably the key unresolved territorial dispute between Serbia and Kosovo will get a new burst of energy from the fact that the Biden team is incoming. The EU is also aware of the need to try and resolve this, maybe possibly while Chancellor Merkel is still Chancellor in Germany, because she is the key actor with President Macron on these issues, and they will have the support of the Biden team in trying to bring this to a close. Lots of skepticism about that, not sure myself, but from what we're hearing from Lajcak in particular, that by the spring of next year, they would like to come close to what is being called a normalization between the two. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much for keeping to our agreed time. Can we go straight on to Karina, please?
Absolutely. Thank you, Christopher and Megan, for the invitation. It's great to be back with LSE Ideas. This is a great conversation already, so thanks for inviting me. I would maybe start by taking a look at some of the main priorities that we've seen coming out from the Biden campaign ever since the beginning of this year, as well as after the confirmation of his victory, of President-elect Biden's victory, and something that I think will feature prominently in his foreign policy agenda. So I think one of the main, and all of these will have an impact on the wider region, of course, the Black Sea region in particular as well. One of the main things that will sort of shape Biden's foreign policy is going to be his efforts to rebuild the country domestically. I think we've heard a lot during the campaign and also from the transition team more recently that the foreign policy will be built somewhat on the domestic policy, rebuilding the middle class, rebuilding the economy after the Trump presidency, and particularly after the COVID-19 crisis. And this, of course, will have an impact on trade partnerships, international trade partnerships, supply chains, China being majorly triggered by this. Then I think one really important element that will have an impact on the region is this idea that the US needs to push for an international community of shared values and the reestablishing a set of normative tools that will inform actors' behavior on the global scene. And Ivan already talked about this normative aspect of the Biden foreign policy, which I find very relevant. And here I would group a couple of things. One is the fight against authoritarians, so kind of strengthening the democratic nations to push back against Russia, China, potentially Iran, and other malign actors. But also the emphasis on the value of alliances, and that has a tremendous value for the countries in the region, and the emphasis on multilateralism. And as President Biden has said, putting the U.S. at the head of the table again, so reinforcing U.S. leadership in kind of leading a lot of the initiatives that unfortunately in the past 4 years have not been a top priority for the U.S. leadership. So I believe these main pillars will orient or reorient the relationship with the region. I think one thing to note here is that the Black Sea region, Southeast Europe, is not monolithic. So it's if you look at the Black Sea region, each country has a very particular sort of outlook and relationship with the United States. We also have a mix of kind of security arrangements. We have three countries that are NATO members, two countries that are aspiring to become NATO members, but have ongoing conflicts on their territory with the Russian Federation. And even within the NATO members, there isn't a coherent, cohesive approach to the nature of the threat and how to respond to it in the Black Sea. And so here, I think the approach from the administration will be based on, as Ivan was mentioning before, a lot of continuity, but also a lot of sort of rebuilding certain things that perhaps were not approached well during the Trump administration, particularly perhaps with Turkey. I think that's going to be a major focus for the administration. And also from what we're hearing from the Biden team and this focus on multilateralism, I think a new Biden administration will look more into how they can leverage existing formats of cooperation. We've seen that a little bit with the Three Seas Initiative from the Trump administration. I think that's going to continue. And I think that's an important vehicle. And there seems to be bipartisan support for that. Also reinforcing NATO and NATO's role in the region, more so than bilateral agreements that in the past 4 years have in a way created this competitive environment among allies, which is detrimental to the security of the Eastern flank and the Black Sea region, of course. And I think the response from the countries in the region has been the correct one, pointing to looking at the Eastern flank security as a sort of one piece of the puzzle and looking at how you can strengthen deterrence and defense by looking at the entire flank and not splitting it up in countries based on political preferences and so on. And I think another point of perhaps continuity, but also where more development is needed is in the area of economic investment. I think the U.S. lags behind in terms of foreign direct investment in all of these countries. And I think all of them badly need to see the U.S. more anchored, not just in security terms, but also in economic terms. And there is an appetite for that. And I think there are security implications as well. And so that's something, and not just sort of traditional, let's say, strategic industries like energy. So for instance, the recent agreement between the US and Romania regarding the nuclear plant, that's kind of a landmark decision, but also in other areas of as well. And I would also point out to something that you, Christopher, mentioned in the beginning, and that's the focus on values of democracy and rule of law. And I think I'm particularly encouraged by this priority of the Biden administration. I think they're very important, and hopefully they will fill the gap that the U.S. has left also in relation to the European Union. And of course, in some countries, this might lead to some anxiety. I think it will be interesting to watch what type of engagement the new U.S. administration will have with the countries in the region, and whether we will see, for instance, what a lot of the countries hope to get, high-level visits and engagement, something that in many countries we haven't seen. Romania is one of them, kind of dearly hoping to have a U.S. president visit Romania again. But also this, what the type of engagement will also be used as a powerful tool that can be utilized differently with different countries. And I think we can expect a lot more engagement with some sort of local civil society actors, kind of alternative poles of power in society. And one last thing perhaps is on this idea of the US-EU cooperation, where a lot of work to rebuild the relationship needs to be done. And I expect to see a lot of that. And Ivan also talked about this in his remarks. I think a lot of the things that are happening, since we're talking about sort of the fringes of the EU, are part of the EU neighborhood, of the EU's strategic, if not vital, interests. And I think the perception, particularly this year, has been that both the US and the EU have been absent. They have been absent from Nagorno-Karabakh. They have been absent, perhaps, for a long time from Belarus. And I think we can expect, or at least hope, that the US and the EU will work closer together. And the US, as Ivan said, will use its leverage in the region to help the EU push through with some of the projects that could help regional stability and democracy and so on. And I think this is badly needed. But I'll stop here for now, and I'm happy to come back to some of these points later on.
Thank you very much, Karina. So can we just move on to our third and final panelist, Wojciech, if you would say some remarks, please?
Sure. Thank you, Christopher and LSE Ideas, for having me. I'm delighted to be part of this event. Well, since Ivan and Karina covered most of the ground, you know, and actually there are not that much of the points that I would disagree. Let me just briefly speak about three points. One is general, the other is regional, and the third one would be Poland specific. It will be a Poland perspective, not the Poland Polish perspective. So the first point, since I don't have a crystal ball on me, I'm going to base this, my rather speculative remarks on the historical perspective. And drawing from the recent history of the US foreign policy, I would point towards two observations. Well, first, when it comes to US foreign policy, drastic changes do not happen overnight, even over a year. I don't see that this will happen also with the Biden administration. Well, if they happen over, you know, quickly, it's rather a reactive stance to the outside events. And, you know, we can look into the Truman Doctrine or, you know, the so-called war on terror after 9/11 just to illustrate those points. Or even the US reaction to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So we should not expect, and I agree with all the speakers, any kind of tectonic changes in Biden's policy. And the second point is, you know, historically speaking, a presidential candidate's foreign policy agenda rarely survives reality check of the times when they turn into presidents. So some of the declarations that Biden administration made, I mean, Biden team made during the election campaign might not leave to what's going on in the real world. So having said that, and of course, you know, the historical record is also there. We can go back to George W. Bush and his idea of having rather disengaged approach to international affairs. And just after 9 months of his presidency, he basically switched 180 degrees. This is a general point. More regional specific point would be that, of course, Joe Biden as a president and his administration will put more emphasis on the cooperation within the transatlantic realm, and he will attempt to repair rather strained in transatlantic and NATO relations. So I think that's the biggest change that we should expect. From the Central European perspective, that might be a big change in a way, because up to this point, at least here in Poland, the current government, it was mostly relying on the bilateral relations with Washington, very often kind of surpassing or reaching over the heads of the European allies. So that's the one point that I'm sure Biden administration will try to change. My take is that in if you want to repair transatlantic relations, if you want to have the kind of return to the new normal, so to speak, it's necessary to have this multilateral consultations and issues that Trump administration probably didn't have stomach to do, but what is really necessary for intra-alliance cohesion, if you will. And the second change, and it also been highlighted by both speakers and also Christopher, is this change in the sphere of values and ideas. And at least on the rhetorical level, it's very predictable, very probable that Biden administration will speak about liberal democracy, rule of law, and how those values are the foundations for transatlantic security, but also for European unity. And of course, some of the governments, probably in Warsaw and in Budapest, will not be that happy to hear those. But having said that, I would also point out that I don't think that, you know, the discussion about values will trump those hard security interests that are already in place, that the Trump administration continued, along with the first Obama administration when they decided to increase the security and military cooperation. So I don't, even though I welcome, as Corina said, you know, the discussion about ideas and values, I don't think that this will change that much in the, let's say, the security realm and the security cooperation within the Central Europe. It brings me to the third point, the Polish perspective. And the key issue for Central Europe, or for Poland, Central Eastern Europe, is of course Russia and U.S. policy towards Russia, also NATO policies towards Russia. And as far as NATO is concerned, NATO already did its job. There is a enhanced forward presence, and the eastern flank, as far as NATO is concerned, is secure. The question is how Biden's administration is going to deal with Russia. And from what we can hear from the close advisors to President-elect Biden, the strong stance towards Russia, the strong policy of not giving up to Russia is rather here to stay. And what might change, of course, is the style. We've seen with the Trump administration that he kind of, you know, flip-flopped about some of the issues with Russia. And even though at the end of the day, he was very strong about Nord Stream, about sanctions, his admiration to the strong leaders, you know, mostly authoritarian leaders, did not help. Well, I don't think we are going to see the same approach from Biden administration. But like I said, I don't think also that Biden administration will be quote-unquote soft on Russia. To the contrary, we can even see a stronger rhetoric and more consistency in this policy. Another point, and this will be, you know, one of my final points, is Biden's relation or U.S. relations with Germany and how the, you know, U.S.-German relations are going to be repaired over time. It might not seem like this in Warsaw sometimes, but Germany and also, you know, the U.S.-German relations are also essential to European security. And, you know, the debate about pulling out U.S. troops from Germany, you know, was quite important for, let's say, you know, regional solidarity. It's very likely that the Biden administration will try to reverse Trump's decision and the troops will remain in Germany. And I think also from the perspective of Poland, it's important to not have those little trade talks about who's going to take those troops, which, by the way, is totally impossible. But instead to be more focused on how to rebuild transatlantic relations after the years that were, let's say, not the best for NATO and for transatlantic cohesion. I think I will stop here. I don't want to overuse my time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you to all our panelists. I see there are quite a few questions already appearing. So I'm going to hand over to my colleague, Megan. Megan, if I could just put two questions on the table, which it's entirely up to the panelists whether they want to pick them up or not. They may prefer some of the other questions coming from the audience. But my first question I would say is that all three of you have stressed the importance of continuity as well as discontinuity in all of this. One of the continuities, of course, is that the Biden administration will be staffed largely by former Obama people. In fact, many people have suggested it's going to look like even more like the Obama administration than the Obama administration itself did. So is that a continuity that is worth discussing? Because Obama wasn't that popular in Eastern Europe in his period because of his position, which was considered to be rather weak on Russia in some cases, or not. So that's one question. And the second is the biggest discontinuity of all, of course, is the pandemic. And so it's quite clear that neither the United States nor Europe is going to get back into any normal shape until 2022. At the earliest, next year is going to still be a COVID year. And what are the likely implications of that, which leaves both parties rather weak in terms of credibility in the outside world for dealing with something like this, and of course, in terms of their economic clout, which is much diminished. All our economies are going to look seriously weak by the end of next year. So with those two questions, Megan, can I hand over to you? I think there are 7 or 8 questions already stacking up.
Yes, thank you. Perhaps our panelists would like to respond to your comments and question before we go into the audience questions. I can't see if anyone's just heard it. Ivan, would you like to come in?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Well,
Let me tackle Christopher's important questions. Indeed, there's so much similarity between these teams. As both Corinna and Wojciech has said, the style and tone will definitely be a huge difference with this, may I say, quote unquote, interlude of 4 years of Trump. And there will certainly be more stability back in the Euro-Atlantic arena, which, despite the pivot to Asia, which, as we all know, started under Obama. I was listening to Charlie Kupchan just yesterday, who was Obama's Europe advisor, who said, you know, the fears of the U.S. completely strategically focusing on Asia are overstretched at this point. I mean, you know, nobody knows what kinds of events will be driving this, but Europe will remain a key focus. The NATO strengthening, of course, with the requirement and focus on having Europe to spend more and maybe even more importantly, to spend better in a coordinated way rather than dissolving resources into doubling up things. So I think that given the history of Joe Biden, the fact that he's been in foreign policy for so long and is such a so cognizant of Europe is important. And as you've heard, they have said that this is the kind of most French-speaking U.S. administration, foreign policy administration that's come in. Tony Blinken has lived there. John Kerry speaks it. Interestingly, Tony Blinken's father was ambassador to Hungary in the early 90s, which I don't think is irrelevant to these issues. And just one sentence on the pandemic. Clearly, Christopher, this is a game changer in many ways. We certainly don't know what kind of fallouts there will be in economic terms and other. But in terms of strategic issues, I don't think, you know, barring who knows what kind of events as the pandemic unfolds, I don't think we'll see significant shifts because of the pandemic itself.
And Wojciech, would you like to come in on Christopher's questions?
Yes, I will just add one small comment to Ivan's excellent remarks. Be cautious with expecting, like some of the people in Central Europe, that Biden administration will bring the old, almost like mythical, good relations between the United States and Europe. Of course, there will be a change, but the times that Europe played a central point of the U.S. strategy, I think, is long gone. And of course, we can talk about improvements and going back to, let's say, 2015, 2016, but still, I think that the two issues that are kind of on the U.S. agenda, one is pandemic that Christopher just mentioned, the other is competition with China, and I think the question for European allies in NATO is, you know, can we fit in? Can we really be part of the great game, or we will just stay on the sidelines? So that's the only point I would like to make. Thank you.
Megan, if I may jump in real quickly here. Thank you. I think this is a great question about whether the Biden administration will look and act like the Obama administration. And I think there is a bit of kind of discussion about this, particularly among more conservative thinkers and policy experts. But I think the last 4 years have been an incredible learning opportunity for the Biden team. From the things that we're seeing from coming up from close advisors and the transition team, I don't think we can expect kind of a replay of the Obama administration. And I think in terms of competition with Russia in particular and maintaining that hard tone on Russia, I think that's going to be different from the Obama years, particularly after 2016 when Biden was vice president and they had to deal with, and they were slow in reacting and taking the right measures to prevent and punish Russia for the interference in the 2016 elections. And I think with that lesson in mind, the approach to Russia in particular is going to be different. And I don't think we will see a lot of concessions and a lot of sort of strategic dialogue, to use a European leader's terminology here, other than on arms control deals. And on the pandemic, just one caution. I think, you know, there's a lot of, and I agree with Wojtek, there's a lot of enthusiasm in Europe about the Biden administration and rekindling the relationship with the EU, but I think everyone should sort of temper the expectations, because there will be a very hard time for everyone in terms of economy, and it will be unavoidable that a lot of the leaders, not just the US leadership, will have to focus on dealing with the crisis at home. And I think this needs to be sort of in our mind as we're looking towards Washington.
Thank you. We do have a lot of questions, so I hope we'll have time to get through them all. We have voted to the top of the questions by our audience. A question from David Webster from the UK Romania Group. David asks, there are plenty of shortcomings with the Trump administration and its foreign policy, particularly in terms of European alliances, but its higher risk strategy in the Middle East is showing some positive signs of breaking a stasis. Should we be happy about a return to normality under Biden if this just means falling back into stale ideas and a process-dominated approach to Russia? So that's very much feeding on from your comments, Corina. I don't know if you would like to immediately respond.
Sure. I'm not an expert in Middle East, so I'll let that I'll leave that to others to answer. But I do, again, just to reinforce, I don't think it's going to be we're not going to fall back on the things that we used to see. Of course, there are a lot of unknowns, and just a reminder that the political dynamic inside the United States also matters. You know, the power balance in Congress, you know, the ability of the Biden administration to work with Congress and so on. But I think based on what we've known so far from this very activist Congress in the past 4 years on foreign policy side, combined with a Biden administration that seems intent to counter Russian and Chinese malign sort of activities, I expect to see a lot more coherence and points of consensus there in pushing back against Russia and China. And then on return to normality, yes, in terms of style and discourse, but I would say this is a really great thing. And the Biden team is very experienced. Ivan talked about this at the beginning, and they are people who have the president-elect's confidence, you know, trust and backing. And I think that's going to make a difference in how the new administration is going to engage with allies and partners, including in kind of dealing with foreign malign threats.
Thank you. I think we'll move on to the next question, as we do have so many in. And this one is in particular directed at Ivan. This is from Giovanna Vuletic, who's a postgraduate candidate at King's College. It's a long question, which I believe the panelists and the Zoom audience can read.
I've read it.
So I'll just paraphrase very succinctly. It's asking about Serbia's relationship with Trump and its triangular relationship with Kosovo, Trump and Vucic. Would you like to respond to that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll try and be as short as I can, given the number of questions. Well, you know, the obvious thing to say is that if you're invited to the Oval Office at the White House, this is not an invitation you refuse, either for President Vucic or for Prime Minister of Kosovo, Abdullah Hoti. So I think it's a sort of a non-starter to somehow say that this was trying to pander to Trump. Clearly, there were sympathies, definitely the fact that there were statements in that regard, but President Vucic never went as far, for example, of the Prime Minister of Slovenia a NATO and EU member who congratulated Trump on his victory in the election. As you know, that was sort of the most far-reaching pro-Trumpian statement. With regards to the effects, I don't think it will have effects. As I said, I do believe, and there's a question further down, and so I'll put it in here, that the intention to create and have this office opened, which it is, of the U.S. International Development Finance Corporation, which, again, I repeat, covers the whole of the region, including Greece, is very important. And it goes back to Karina also, I think, underscoring the importance of more U.S. foreign direct investments, the need for more economic presence of the United States. Just as a footnote, the famous now defunct idea of a gas pipeline created by the West, the Nabucco pipeline, which the investors then said, well, it's not profitable, opened the space for Russia to create first a South Stream, which was abandoned, and now we have the Turkish Stream, which will be fueling Russian gas. So on a broader point, which I didn't have time to mention, the diversification of energy supplies for this whole region, from Estonia in the north to Bulgaria and Greece in the south, is extremely important. And Croatia has just announced the opening of its LNG facility in the island of Krk, which will be linked to one of the Polish ones in the north, which I think is important, just to give a pushback on Russia and the kind of important role that it has in energy supplies for the whole of Europe, for that matter, but especially for these regions.
Thank you. I'd like to move on to several members of the audience who asked questions regarding Turkey. The one that's most popular with the audience is from Stefani Tasheva, which is a clash in the Mediterranean between Turkey and Greece, potentially involving other NATO member states, will undoubtedly have its impact on other Balkan countries. Do you believe the US under Biden will aim to contain Turkey and get more involved in the dispute over natural gas resources in the region? I wonder if Ivan, you'd also like to pick up on this.
Well, I can say a few words. I mean, clearly this has been and continues to be one of the main contentious issues, and it really heated up in so many ways with France coming strongly to back Greece and Chancellor Merkel trying to calm things down through diplomatic means, Turkey sort of doing pendulum swings of sending out its research ship and then pulling it back, then sending it back again. I certainly think that the Biden role the role of the administration could be greater than it was. Erdogan is one of these populist authoritarian leaders that we've seen trying to beef up his role. And as was mentioned again, I think by Karina, the fact that there was an absence of European and US role in the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict gave Russia and Turkey more leverage, not to mention Syria, what's going on there. So I think one would expect the US to try and have a bigger role in its relationship with Turkey, which we know is a long-standing relationship, and to try and see to it that things calm down from where they have been.
Thank you. And I'm not sure, did either of the other speakers want to comment on that? Not seeing any gestures. In that case, I'll move on to our next question. I'm going to move things a little further north and eschew the voting system, I'm afraid, for the questions. So I was hoping Wojciech might be able to come in on this one. Sorry, it's just moved because everyone is asking so many questions. It was a question from Giada D'Andrea, who's an MA student at Charles University. Taking into consideration the current democratic backsliding in the Visegrad group, and in particular in Poland and Hungary, would you expect this phenomenon to attenuate or even reverse thanks to Biden's endorsement of the European Union?
Well, thanks for the question. And I do expect that this trend will be reversed, but I wouldn't kind of give it to Biden's pressure or even European Union pressures. I think that as with all those democratic transitions in the region, it has to come from the inside. And of course, right now, and I can speak mostly for what's going on in Poland, not in Hungary. Of course, you know, the intellectual elites, they read New York Times, the economists, they know that the pressure is there, that that the European Union is actually putting pressure on Poland and other countries that are really kind of, you know, not necessarily following the European style of the rule of law, to put it mildly. But I wouldn't expect that it would be for Biden's administration pressure. It might add up to some of the diplomatic discussions, but it has to come from the inside. That would be my take, at least in Poland. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry, I was muted. Ivan, did you want to come in on this?
No, I'll skip that one.
I saw you were unmuted. In that case, I will move on. I'm going back to the popular questions according to the audience. We have a question from Marcus Fung, who is a Westbourne School student, who asks, with all these initiatives coming from Biden's foreign policy, how do you expect Russia, China, or other rivals to respond to these new investments and approaches from the US? So, Karina, would you like to come in on this?
Sure, maybe very briefly. I would say, unfortunately, the United States and, let's say, the Western Alliance doesn't have the sort of the escalation prerogative in this and the strategic initiative. And this is something that I think the Western community needs to regain. So the responses, I think what we are going to see from Russia and China is perhaps more of the same. And that's in part because it has taken the Western Alliance quite a bit of time to figure out how to respond, how to push back. We're still not there yet, and we're still sort of answering questions from before, not things that are coming up from these countries. So I would rather focus on how we strengthen the transatlantic alliance, how we strengthen our democratic systems so that there is less penetration from Russia and China, and how we strengthen our sort of economic systems as well. And I think a lot of this will depend on how the US and the EU will be able to work together. And there's a strong regulatory component to that too, in regulating foreign capital, illicit financing, offshore companies, and in shedding light on all of the malign influence tactics that Russia and China are utilizing and sometimes sort of coordinating, if only in appearance. So I'm not concerned about escalation as I am concerned about not having the ability to kind of lead that process and force the malign foreign actors to react. It's rather been the opposite, that we have been the reactive force.
Thank you. And I have a question here from Marius Mitrach. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name, Marius. Who is a student of European Studies at UBB. This is a question for all speakers, but I wonder perhaps if Wojciech could come in first on this. The question is, what will be Biden's administration's approach towards the Nord Stream gas pipeline and energy security more broadly in Central Europe?
All right, so I think that again, I hate to sound very boring, but it will not change that much from Trump's administration. He will put the pressure for both Russia and Germany to some extent, as the Nord Stream clearly violates some of the Central European countries' energy security interests. But of course, again, I would argue that the subtle difference will be in style. And since, you know, repairing US-German relations is quite high on European Biden agenda, I would argue that, you know, it will be much softer in rhetoric. So rather than threatening to sanction all the companies, including German companies, who would take part in Nord Stream, probably there'll be a softer approach from the Biden's administration. But I would expect at the same time that the criticism against Nord Stream 2 will be there. Not only because of it kind of violates Central Eastern European interests, but mostly it also is against some of the energy security interests of the United States. Thanks.
Thank you. We only have about 5 minutes left according to our scheduled timing, so I only have time for a few more questions. So I'd just like to tell the audience there are quite a number of questions about Greece and Turkey and that aspect of Eastern Mediterranean influence in the Balkans particularly. We will be having another 2020 Visions talk specifically addressing that region. So I won't prioritise those questions for today. I do apologise that we haven't got the time to answer them all. So I'd like to ask a question. I think this one is probably best for Ivan. This is from Dino Pasilic, who asks, since the European Union is disinterested in having the West Balkans six countries join anytime soon, could we hope for Biden's administration to see accelerated NATO membership for those countries as a quicker fix to a number of key challenges in the region?
Well, thank you to Dino Pasilic for that question. Well, first of all, there are already three of the Western Balkan six that are members of NATO, Albania, Montenegro, and North Macedonia. For the other three, as I said, Serbia is in the highest possible relationship, barring the membership action plan. And so I think the name of the game is to try and get them more involved in these activities. And frankly, more importantly, I would say that one would want to urge the European Union to take more proactive steps before membership for all of these countries to bring them into a variety of activities and to be at the table of the European Union. The simplest one and most immediate is why don't these countries sit at the table of this meeting of the future of Europe that is being organized? But many more things like that are possible, I believe, and could be done.
Thank you. I'm going to take two questions and put them together as one. This is open for whoever wishes to answer. The first is from Paul Naldret, who asks, do the past 4 years of the Trump presidency indicate that regardless of who sits in the White House, Europe needs to be stronger with its own defence commitments and organisation? And the second question is from Gabor Papp, who's at a University of Szeged alumnus. Gabor asks, do you think that the US can divide its attention properly? In the past, the Middle East acted like a magnet to US foreign policy, and with China becoming more assertive than ever, and Asia Pacific probably becoming the most important security problem, will the US have time at all to look at this region and to deal with issues like liberalism in Hungary and Europe's eastern flank? So I think perhaps I'm going to pick on Karina for this, if you wouldn't mind picking up on those two questions.
Sure, absolutely. I think that's always been the challenge, right, with the US administration, that there are a series of competing priorities, sometimes very different ones from all over the world. And European nations, particularly on the Eastern flank, have been keen to be on that map for the US administration. So that's always been the case. I do think that a country like the United States has the ability to focus on multiple priorities at once. And particularly going back to this idea that the US needs to lead and sit at the head of the table, I think the new administration will be mindful of how to balance different challenges. But here, I would say that the importance of various multilateral formats, G7, G20, international organizations, partnerships with the European Union or NATO will come into play. So the US doesn't have to be the main force driving all of these initiatives. And I think perhaps we will see a lot more reliance, at least in some areas, on these particular groupings, be they regional or global and so on. And I think that ties into whether the EU should be encouraged to deepen its security and defense cooperation. And I think the answer is yes. We're going back to a conversation about whether this can be done in confrontation with the US or kind of in cooperation with the US and with NATO. And of course, I'm a proponent of the latter. And I think the EU should continue to strengthen its capacities in terms of defense and security and kind of turn into action what the president of the EU Commission said in her speech, wanting to make the Commission a more geopolitical commission. So kind of project that stability and security outside its borders in its vicinity. I think the difference will be this time that instead of kind of blaming the European Union and labeling them as the enemy, we will see a lot more support from the US on some of these agendas.
Thank you.
At least we'd like to believe that.
We are running out of time. So I'm going to ask one final question, which I think works quite nicely as a sort of wrapping up final thoughts question before we hand back to Professor Coker for his final remarks. So the question is from Robert Cooper. And the question is, could each of the panelists please tell us the three things that they would like the US to do? I assume he means in regards to foreign and defence policy in Central and Southeast Europe. So perhaps we could go in reverse order to how we began. So if we start with Wojciech, and then Karina, and then Ivan, and then we'll hand back to Christopher. So Wojciech, what three pieces of advice would you give the Biden administration or requests?
Well, three. I'm a minimalist and I would go with one, which is to send a very strong signal, both in terms of rhetoric, but also to in terms of diplomatic commitment to European security architecture under also the new administration. So I think that the last 4 years, they've been tough for a number of different reasons. It would be too easy to just point out at one person or one administration. And I think the transatlantic relations, they need a new opening. And even if, in some European capitals, it's obvious that transatlantic relations are here to stay, I think that, there is certain doubt that the US will be committed to Europe, as a whole. So, I don't have three of those. I don't want to go into the details, but I think this one would be, from my perspective, particularly important also for the Central Europe. And also because I think that what we've seen recently, it was this what I call bilateralization of the security relations with the United States, instead of just building the broad framework within NATO about European security. Thank you.
Thank you. And Karina?
Thank you, Megan. I think I have a longer list than Wojtek. A few things. I would like to see the US administration continue to be involved in the 3 C's initiative. And kind of act a bit of as a broker, and sometimes it's needed given that relationships between allies in our region and neighbors have not always been smooth and easy to navigate. So I think that type of brokerage is needed, but also the financial resources are needed. So I hope that we'll continue to exist and also deepen, again, working with the European Union on this. And related to that, I'd like to see the Biden administration working with the EU on perhaps a joint China strategy, or pushing back to foreign authoritarian interference strategy. I think there are signs in Europe that there is more of an awakening in some important Western capitals that China constitutes a threat. And I think the nature of the threat is better understood today than perhaps even a year ago. And so I would like the US administration to really put a lot of effort and resources into that. And speaking of authoritarianism, my third thing on the wish list is that I would like to see the US work politically and diplomatically with the EU and back the EU's efforts to kind of uphold democratic values and rule of law inside its borders, but also in Eastern Partnership countries and Western Balkans and so on. So have a little bit more alignment politically and diplomatically. I think that's important, but also at a more, let's say, operational level, just use the opportunity of this kind of renewed hope to work together on specific projects. I think the Magnitsky legislation is a great example of how, for instance, the European Parliament and the US Congress can work together. And I think there is an array of issues dealing with fraud, transnational kleptocracy, sanctions regime, corruption, and so on, where the EU and the US can work together to strengthen the sort of the international norms on this and make it less possible for kleptocrats, corrupt officials, oligarchs, and so on to kind of take advantage of our democracies. And related to that, also working on perhaps the technology part of it, which we didn't get into, but I think that's also where the new administration will have to work really closely with the European Union.
Thank you. And Ivan?
Yeah, thanks very much to Robert Cooper for giving us a chance to say our wishes here. Very much agreeing with what Wojciech and Corinna have said. I will start out and reinforce this point about democracy. The Trump years have really sown doubt, or rather Trump has sown doubt into the democratic values, processes, and checks and balances. And the restoration or coming back to a belief and trust in democratic values and processes is extremely important, and thus a voice of, as he has already announced, sort of a community of democracies coming together is important. And in diplomatic terms, whether it's public or behind closed doors, when he goes to places like Poland and Hungary, just, you know, to remind people of that, while, you know, the strategic orientation is kept, but democracy should be up there, definitely. Secondly, I think spurning investments. There's so much need for infrastructure. You know, if you take the train from Berlin to Prague to Vienna, you're still traveling as if you were in the 50s, trains traveling at 60 kilometers an hour. You know, the Europeans should get their act together on key infrastructure developments. There are plans now for high-speed trains in Central and Eastern Europe, things like that, but the Americans could also give their share. And I repeat, the fact that the Development Finance Corporation has come in is not an insignificant move. And finally, and of course, given from where I come from, which is Serbia, although I'm in Vienna now, is to help move forward the process on the Serbia-Kosovo dialogue. I think the US has a key role to play, notwithstanding the important fact that the EU is and will remain in the driving role here.
Thank you. And over to Professor Gerges.
Thank you, Megan. Well, first of all, apologies to our participants. I can see there are at least 10 more questions that could have been asked. We will be revisiting some of these issues next year together with the RATSEU Forum. I'd like to thank our panelists, who we would like to see again next year. Thank you very much for finding the time to do this. We started out the Central and Southeast Europe program 2 years ago at LSE Ideas because we were convinced that Eastern and Central Europe, having been to some extent sidelined, both historically and politically, since the end of the Cold War, we're going to move center stage. We're going to become, to use the term I used before, much more interesting to a lot of external actors, much more interesting to the European Union and the United States. And I think that our speakers have suggested that that is going to be one of the key themes that will emerge over the next 4 years of the Biden administration. So thanks again to everyone. Thanks again to you, the participants, for tuning in, and to Megan for organizing this particular session. And we look forward to seeing some of you again in the very near future. Goodbye from me.
Thank you very much.